Ben Johnson is the best there is in the 100-meter sprint. And they're trying to discredit my name. They're trying to erase my name, but they can't erase my name. I have lots of fans all over the world. I got a lot of fans here in Toronto. I have a lot of fans in Italy, in Europe, wherever I go out and travel, worldwide. People love me. People talk to me. People want to take pictures of me, autograph and everything. They can erase those love from people.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Tourist Information. Going back to September 24th, 1988, Ben Johnson won the 100-meter final at the Summer Olympics in Seoul with a world record time of 9.79 seconds. He was the fastest human being who ever lived. And 48 hours later, he became one of the most disgraced athletes who ever lived when he tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs. There is a new book that has just come out called The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson, World's Fastest Man, Revisiting the Man at the Center of Canada's Steroid Scandal. It's written by Mary Ormsby, who covered Johnson at those Olympics, and she did so for the Toronto Star. And it was fascinating. I was nine at the time in Vancouver, and Canada, that I think our national identity is so much defined by just not being American. I don't really know what we are. Mocking our patriotism, as say South Park did, was something that we all relished. I remember seeing that in the theater, just how funny it was. Blame Canada. Try and do the same thing to an American. Doesn't feel the same. There's no faster place that Americans go to hide any kind of nefarious activity than patriotism, hide behind the flag. So with Johnson and this scandal, it was fascinating to see how quickly a disgraced Canadian champion became a disgraced Canadian-Jamaican champion, and then very quickly a Jamaican disgraced champion. And there was a lot about sort of anti-immigrant fervor that seemed to fuel some of that he had betrayed the country that had taken him in. And spoke to me a little bit, just as my mom and grandfather came over as refugees and immigrants, the slur for white people that's most commonly used, honky. I thought first it was attributable to something against Elvis Presley. No, it was against Hungarians. It was against them, where they came from, which most people still are surprised to learn about that. So Johnson was complicated, what he represented. And this book is important for him to get across that while he readily admits he did cheat with performance-enhancing drugs for years, that what he was caught with was not what he used. Is that a distinction without a difference? Yes, I think so, on the whole. He is firmly convinced that Canada betrayed him and should have stood up for him, and I listened to that and asked, in any way, do you feel that you betrayed the country? Like, what is your culpability in this? And he wasn't really having that. So I didn't really see the value in going all adversarial with him. When, before this book came out, I was fishing around for Ben Johnson just because it was electrifying for the entire country to see what Ben did. And I particularly loathe Carl Lewis on a lot of different levels as an athlete, and just the way he carried himself was incredibly annoying, and Ben destroying him at those games was thrilling. But how much does Ben Johnson hold on to this scandal and the heights that he achieved? Well, I found a website that I was sure was phony, and an even more ersatz phone number attached to it asking you to contact Ben. And it listed his number, and the number included not just his world record time, but also the year in which he did it. I thought, there's just no possible way this is him. I put the number into my phone. I went over to WhatsApp to see if it corresponded to a picture or something. There Ben was in 1988. A picture came up, and I sent a message just politely trying to ask if he would talk. And 2 days ago, he said 3 p.m. tomorrow. And there he was at the other end of the line. Very surreal, very strange. It's 36 years after this event. This 27-year-old who was the world's fastest man is now 61. And it's bizarre just how close all of this remains to him. So I tried to just see where he stood with it and not really bother being adversarial. So anyway, a weird guest, but a fascinating one, fascinating figure. The world was fixed to what he achieved and then very quickly how he achieved it. Ben Johnson, this week's guest on Tourist Information. Thanks for listening.
Hello.
Hello, is that Ben?
Yes.
Hi, Ben. This is Brent Butler. How are you?
Not bad.
Just one second. I'll start recording. Thank you for your time today.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just wanted to know how it feels with this new book, World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. What does it feel like to have this book come out now? What does the world need to hear about you that it doesn't understand?
The world need to understand that that the lab result test that they did was not even my test. It was just a paper that was on my name. Everything was all scratched out. Everything was marked up. Different people was involved with the lab report. The government of Canada knows about it. They didn't do anything about it. They locked away for 30 years. 30 years they locked away for. So you got the question, what's going on? And so forth, you know. So it was not fair the way I was treated.
Yeah. How many people do you think were cheating in that race back on September 24th, 1988 in Seoul?
I do believe that most of the runners was using performance enhancing, not because they didn't look any bigger or smaller, but you can look on the body type that they were much leaner, they were more tighter, you know, so you can know that they're using something. You know, you don't have to use drugs to be big or small. You can tell. And on that level of sprinting on the world stage, everybody is doing something. And it was just a level playing field, you know. I wasn't doing something differently what nobody was doing. I was just doing the same thing. It's just a matter of I was doing it better and faster than everybody else.
Right. Do you believe, I know that Carl Lewis had tested positive for, I believe, three different banned substances. Do you think he was cheating on that day as well?
Well, I can't say, but I know that when he beat me in Zurich, his body looked totally different. And he came to run. Right? And yeah. And you know, just the way it is, you know, he was protected by America, by the sponsors and by his government.
How often do you turn your thoughts back to September 24th, 1988, winning in such an incredible way, breaking the world record, probably being able to run it faster if you hadn't raised your hand? How much do you think about that day, and how much do you think about 3 days after when this scandal erupted?
Well, winning that race was what I trained for 12 years, to be the best I can be on that day, and I proved it. And 24 hours later, or 48 hours later, I was test positive. And when they mentioned that the drugs that they find me with, I know right away that was a foul play. Something went wrong in the lab. My moms always say, all the time, son, the only way they can beat you is in the lab. They cannot beat you on the track or anywhere else, in the lab. So I know this. This can happen. Even before it happened, I know about this. So this is not something new to me when it really happened, because that's the only way they can beat me. And if I'm going to test positive, I want to test positive for the drugs that I use, not something that I didn't use. So this becomes a really big puzzle situation, right?
Right.
So it doesn't add up. And why I'm going to take something on that day. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work on that day. Knowingly, I'm going to win the race. Knowingly, I'm going to be tested. You know what I mean? I would be a jackass to do that. So there's got to be some foul play was involved in my disqualification.
And I saw you interviewed in the documentary 9.79, the ESPN 30 for 30, where Carl Lewis and his trainer had a friend who entered into your room somehow just before the race, and there's allegations that he may have spiked something you were drinking, and he wouldn't even give a definitive answer about whether he did it or not. He said, maybe I did, maybe I didn't. Can you speak to that incident?
Well, when I first walked into that control room where all the athletes will select from the official to present your urine, I walked in, I saw this guy on the ground wearing a Mizuno pouch and sitting beside the fridge. And I look on his accreditation, he said, America, Andre Jackson. I said, you're in the wrong room. This is gold medal, first place. Second place is on the other side. Oh, I only come to congratulate you on your race and blah, blah. I said, thank you very much. And you know, Valdemar was working on my Achilles because my Achilles flares up on me. He was in a lot of pain. And he was sitting beside the fridge, and I asked him to pass me a beer. And I passed him the beer. I opened the can, laid the can down on the ground. I was in agony, in a lot of pain. And while he was working on my Achilles, and knowingly that's when he slipped some of the steroid stuff in my drink on the floor because nobody was watching him. Everybody was focused on my Achilles. I was in pain. My head was bowed down, and that's where everything happened. It took me 2.5 hours to present my urine. I was struggling getting drunk because I couldn't go to the washroom. And I was trying to celebrate my win afterwards. Mm-hmm. And then we heard the news in 24 hours.
What is your relationship now like with your career? I mean, you were just 26 years old in Seoul. You're 62 now. Would you do this over again with all you've been through, the highs and lows?
Well, you know, all the hard work I did is for my mother. You know, I love my mother dearly, and I want to make sure that she have a good life and doesn't have to work hard and, you know, going up early in the morning. So all of my career, all of my hard working, the dedication, the sweat, the agony, the pain, the suffering was for my mother to give her a better life. And I did that. And I took her around all over the world with me, racing and so forth, to show how much I love her. And then have this thing happen to me where what I worked for almost 12 years or over 12 years in 1 second, it was all gone in a flash of a blink of an eye.
What is it like to deal with the pressure that you have to deal with as a sprinter where one mistake out of the gates, you can lose a race. You probably will lose a race at that level. How did you deal with that pressure of just having to achieve perfection in 100 meters or else you could finish last potentially?
Well, you know, when you're training for all these years, you know, you're focused mentally, physically, emotionally to prepare on that given day. And that day, if anything is aching or anything is not working very well, then that day the body has to perform because the mind controls the body. And there's many times in my career in training where I don't feel great, I don't feel good, and I feel good a few days later. I have to make sure that when I'm ready to perform, no matter what, how I feel, the muscles and the body has to perform on that given day. So I train my mind and my body to work together as a unit to perform on that day. And that's what I trained for 12 years, for 6 days a week, for 12 years. You know, a lot of people doesn't know this. I trained for 12 years, never missed one practice. That's how dedicated I was to the sports and to my career. Yes, I do go out to parties and have some fun and with my friends, but I do come back home and perform like I didn't do anything.
How old were you when you first came to Canada from Jamaica?
I was only 14 years old.
That's something I thought was really interesting about this book. I myself was born in Canada, and the book points out that the backlash included a fair bit of racism related to you, where you went from Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson to Jamaican-Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson to Jamaican Ben Johnson. I think that's something that people kind of forgot, is the backlash included a big racial element. Could you speak to that?
Well, there is a backlash on racism. I mean, if anybody was in my position, who would give that kind of answers to, that person will feel really, really bad. And that person who said this to me doesn't understand the sports. He doesn't understand the pressure what athletes go through. And for him to make a statement like that, it's not fair for him to even say that at all. I know I'm from Jamaica. I still talk Jamaican. I do everything I do is Jamaica. My people still love me wherever I go, in Jamaica or anywhere in the world or here in Toronto. I went to events. My people support me all the time, all the way, because they know exactly what the game is. They know exactly the politics. They know exactly, because I'm not white, this thing happened to me. Yes, we have bad and good people everywhere. I got white, too, in my family. Like, white as a driven snow in my family. Okay? That doesn't mean that they are a bad person. They're a good person. But you have good and bad people everywhere. And these people that put me on the bus, they're not good people at all. And these people are used. They dirty politics, because they have the power can do that. And that's not fair. And there's other athletes, also Canadian athletes, who win gold medal, also test positive, keep their medal, still make their living, still keep their sponsors. But for Ben Johnson, they threw me under the bus. And I'm coming back than ever, and better than ever before. And I believe in God, and I believe in Jesus Christ, that he's always with me, he never leave me, and when his time comes, he will open the door for me.
Do you think there's any way to keep performance-enhancing drugs out of sport at the most elite level?
No. People are always trying to get the edge, want the edge, and they would do anything to get that edge. And when there is money on the table, on contracts and sponsorship, people don't find a way to be ahead of the system or to be ahead of one step ahead of everything. So they're always going to be somebody doing something. It never a fair playing field at all. Somebody is doing something.
Do you believe the time that you set in 1988, 9.79, has that ever been beaten without the use of performance-enhancing drugs, in your opinion?
Well, I do believe that the human body can perform to a certain level. If you believe in it, it's all mental. I think that taking performance-enhancing drugs was just to train hard to recovery. And the more shape you're in and recovery, the faster you're going to run. Well, maybe it might help by 10%, but sprinter was born, not made. And I have the God-gifted talent. One of the best body in track and field to do what I do, and I do it the best.
In 1988, when you stepped onto that track in Seoul, how much did you weigh? You're about 5'9.5", is that right?
5'9.5", 172 pounds. And when I'm running, I'm six five, six six when I'm running. 12 meters per second. 12 meters per second, top speed. And 9 feet in length. You cannot, once you start running 9 feet in length, you got to run in like 9'6" or 9'7" to run that kind of stride. This is physics. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. One time, Lance Armstrong, I asked him if he had not taken performance-enhancing drugs, where would he have finished in the Tour de France? And he said he didn't believe he could have qualified for the Tour de France. There was so much performance-enhancing drug use in the sport. Do you think track is a cleaner place than it was in your time?
Track is not clean. Track is still track. It's never get any cleaner or any less than what it is today. It's going to get even worse. You have these people now. Look at these kids are running now. They're running 9.9. Well, they're running what? 6.41 in the 60 meters at this past Indoor World Championship. I ran that 37 years ago. 37 years ago. And these guys are running on better technology, better track, better shoes. And 37 years ago, these guys just only running 6.41. So right there and then, that's telling you that I'm far away ahead of my time. Way ahead of my time.
So if you were 26 again today with the new technology, what kind of time do you think you could run the 100 meters in now at your best?
Well, let me say this. In 1988 in Seoul, I break every world record from 50 yards, 50 meters, 60 meters. I run 5.50 in the 50 meters. I run 60 meters in 6.33. At 90 meters, I was 9 seconds flat, and that's when I shut down the engine off and then just coast in. So if I was running on this day, same technology, the same track, better running shoes, I would say I can give you like a 9.3, 9.4.
Interesting. You remember,
if there's anybody in the world today can say they can run 9.3 or 9.4, I can run faster than them because they're not faster than Ben Johnson. None.
In 1998, in baseball, you had the big home run derby between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, and now we know performance-enhancing drugs played a role in that. Most fans in baseball, when they were asked, would you rather see records broken knowing that drugs are used or not see records broken or at least have them broken much more rarely, but know everybody was clean? The majority of fans supported drug use. What do you think that says about fans and sports?
Well, listen, everybody come to see entertainment. Whether there's drugs or not in sports, everybody want to see somebody done something magnificent, nothing has been done. It's all about being entertained. And these guys come to run, to come to the audience in any event. If it's soccer, basketball, hockey, or any sports, people come to be entertained. And they're going to be entertained because these athletes is trained to perform at the best on that day. And with those guys doing what they do with the baseball and hit the ball to other home run, drugs doesn't do that. Hit the ball or it's all about the eye coordination. I hit the ball, the timing, and get the ball out of the, out of the stadium. So I don't believe in that. I think if you at least train hard and work hard and recover faster and harder, they can get the results.
When you think back to your relationship with Charlie Francis, how do you see it now, so many years later, after 1988? What does he represent for you?
Charlie's been saying the same thing ever since day one, and I'm saying the same thing since day one, and nothing has been changed. And I'm saying this, Charlie Francis showed the world how to run 9.5 or 9.6 or 9.7, and everybody out there and the coaches out there learn from us. We are the blueprint of track and field. We are the game changer. So nobody can come to me and say that they could beat Ben Johnson. You can't invent the wheel already been invented. And everybody think that because they're running 9.5 or 9.6 or 9.7, the coaches, they think that they're the one who make the difference. No, we are the one who change it, what it is today. And all those guys now know how to do the program for training, to recovery, and the peak performance and everything. It's a science. Everything is a science. And they didn't know how to do it. And that's why I was beating all these guys every time, every given day, because we are far ahead advance of the world in track and field. And they couldn't beat me. So the only way they can beat me is in the lab. Set me up so I can test positive. Which people would do that in their right mind? That's not human. You don't have a heart.
What was the feeling like for you when you crossed that finish line in 1988, winning the gold medal?
I said to myself, job well done. Now I can take a year off and enjoy all the time that I didn't have as a young child growing up to play in the park with my friends. You know, that alone was taken away from me as a child, you know, to play and to grow up as a child like everybody has the chance to. I didn't have that. I went straight into track and field for 12, 14 years of training, rigorous training for 14 years to be the best I can be. And it wasn't easy. It was hard. But I love it. I make it easy because this is something I love. This is something I love to do. And there's a lot of people out there, and some people are jealous of me because I beat them. Come on.
What was your favorite thing about sprinting, about track and field, and the 100 meters in particular?
Well, the training, I don't miss the training. The training is too hard. It's rugged training. It's really physical hard labor of training to be where you want to be and be the best 6 days a week for 12 hours for 12 years. It's a lot of work. People don't see that. All people see is the finished result of me running on TV and they're sitting down in their couch and watching the TV and cheering and stuff like that. But the real training, if these people ever see the training or we train, they say, these people are not human. Okay?
Yeah. And, I mean, did you know when you crossed that finish line that you had a world record?
Even the day before I race or even the day going into the race, I know there was a world record is going to be going. And even when I met the first reaction out of the blocks, I know that the world record was gone because it was so fast that when I moved, no one wasn't moved yet. No one did a move. So I know that my reaction was so great and I just keep running.
How did you feel with what, you know, watching Usain Bolt come up and what he was able to accomplish? What were your thoughts about his career?
I mean, he has a great, you know, he's a great career. I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. He came in like years later and do what he does, you know, which is fine, which is okay. But
would
all
you like
those,
to run
all
against
those,
him? Would you like to have run against him in your prime?
Well, I would love to run against him in my prime, but he would never catch me. That's number one. He can run me down at top speed. That's number two, and I can't be intimidated. That's number three. Those are my strong gifts from above.
Yeah, interesting. I wanted to ask you about Carl Lewis because I heard you in the 9.79 documentary refer to your relationship, your dynamic was sort of like Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. Did it feel like that? Like all of the races leading up to 1988 and 1984, you guys just had such a tremendous rivalry. How did it feel at the time, and how does it feel now, these decades later?
I think, you know, between me and Carl Lewis, the showdown, he beats me, I beat him. You know, leading up to the Olympic Games, it was just more thrill, more entertained to see who's going to come out on top. And, you know, that race was like Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, and George Foreman back in the early 70s. And the whole world wanted to see that, and the whole world seen it. And it was very well much entertained, very, very much well satisfied, and set the record in the process and slowed down at 90 meters.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, in that race, I could run about 9.69, 9.71, 9.72, somewhere around that area. Yes. On a different technology.
Right. And post your running career, it was interesting. I mean, 1997, you became Diego Maradona's trainer. And 2 years later, Muammar Gaddafi hires you as a personal trainer for his son. What did you think your life was going to be like after running when you've given your whole life to it? It just seems unusual, I guess, the direction it went after.
Well, I think I was going to make some good money and invest it and just keep myself healthy and enjoy life as to give and so forth. But that was not the case. My life is like an adventure. So, you know, God have something better planned for me. And I'm just going through the motion of life. And hopefully I can see the sun will shine again for Ben Johnson. One day the sun will shine again for Ben Johnson. And I just want the world to know and to see why this thing happened to me and how it happened and why. And because I was so good and because everybody was losing lots of money in the industry of the business, and they can't allow to see a small shoes company from Italy, Diadora, become the number one shoes company in the world. They could never allow that. And because America can't take any defeat, a black boy from Jamaica, beating the best in the world as America, they didn't like that. And they turned against me. And this is what happened to me. So I'm very happy that I come out of this alive, because my life was in danger. And I want to thank the Lord Jesus Christ of saving my life.
When the Lance Armstrong, all of that came out with him confessing the scandal and everything, I mean, I can't think of a higher profile scandal in sports than what you suffered with performance enhancing drugs. I don't think anything close. What did you think watching that unfold with Lance?
I believe that from my own, I don't have to read or hear it on the news. This is my opinion. He should never gone back. He should just live his life with his wife and his families and take a vacation. Yes, he did what he did. He won, you know, so many world record and title, and to come back, that was a mistake. He should have never come back. He should just be proud of what he has done, what he's achieved as an athlete, as a cyclist, and bygone, and that's it. He should never come back, and that was his mistake.
How much pressure was there for you? I mean, I understand what you're saying about what you were caught with is not the drugs that you were using, but you readily admit that you were taking performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah.
How much pressure was there that could be uncovered for you?
Well, it wasn't enough pressure to say, yes, I will try it, because if everybody else is using performance-enhancing drugs, to me, it's a level playing field, and because I do it better than most people or win the gold medal in a 9.79 seconds or 9.83 seconds, or run some very good time in my career. You know, people was watching me, people was after me, and there are a lot of people jealous. I'm not saying that I didn't take it. Yes, I did, like everybody else. But I'm not going to take the blame for everybody else that taking it, and I'm only poster boy for steroids. No, it's not going to happen. So I'm going to defend myself as much as I can, and I will. And nobody can point a finger at me that I'm guilty or I'm this and that. No, nobody can judge me. The only person can judge me in this planet Earth is Jesus Christ himself or God. Nobody else.
Yeah. Where is life at today for you? What's your day-to-day like? You mentioned you're in Toronto. I don't hear much about your sort of personal life other than kind of every few years.
No, I, I keep my personal life out of the media. I don't like the limelight, even though I'm a top athlete. You know, many people who is in the spotlight in sports get out of the sports, and they doesn't have nothing to do, and they want to be back in the spotlight. I'm not that kind of guy. I like to keep a low profile. I love my life now. Yes, the book get me back into the in the spotlight, but this time it's for a reason, for good reason, to tell the world that I wasn't doing anything wrong that I wasn't doing. I do it better than most people, and because I beat the American, that's what happened. And when it happened to me in 1988, the first thing came to my father's mouth. The first word he said, the American are involved. The second thing he said out of his mouth, that the Canadian government have to protect his son. Never happened.
What do you, how do you feel about Canada then as an immigrant like you were, and as your family who came over to get so much support initially and then to feel like it turned its back on you?
Well, I feel like this country let me down, but my dad's always say when we leave Jamaica in the early years, he said that if a guy's willing to come back to Jamaica, you know, to live, then you have land, you have house here, can come back. And right now, my dad's words is coming back to pass, that I want to do the same thing to go back home and live my life and enjoy myself. That's it.
Do you feel on any level any kind of guilt in relation to letting Canada down with what happened?
I don't let anybody down. If anything let down, they let me down because they should have tried to protect me in the sea. Let me say this. Canada never ready for my success. They're never ready for my great success that I dish out in my career. They wasn't ready. I bring sports into Canada. Canada, there was no sports here in Canada. All they had was the Blue Jays and the Toronto Argonauts, and there wasn't really any world title or anything. I bring sports what it is today. I'm the guy who changed the whole entire sports here in Canada or in Toronto, you should say. Ben Johnson.
And at your peak, I mean, it seemed like you had clothing companies. Just describe it for people who weren't there. I mean, what kind of income are you making as a sprinter at that time? Because it's not as lucrative as so many of these other sports. I'm just curious, what was your lifestyle like at your peak?
I was getting the same contract as Michael Jordan has. Michael Jordan has about 9 to 10% shares in Nike. Michael Jordan made Nike what it is today. Ben Johnson has the same contract with Diadora. I have $6 million worth of clothing line in the warehouse in Italy when the gold medal. That's about $500 million in revenue. I get $2 on every item sell of the Ben Johnson clothing line. And because when I designed the colors of my clothing line and what I wanted, I used the Jamaican colors, black and gold. And because I designed that colors and all the companies, shoes companies, didn't like it, the colors, that this company is going to be the best in the world in shoe sales, they have to pull the plug on Ben Johnson, and that's exactly what I did. It got nothing to do what I was doing, taking performance enhancing drugs. It was due because I changed shoes company to Diadora, and that is a living truth. And even on my dying bed, I can tell you the same thing because I know this is what happened to Ben Johnson.
I guess last question, Ben, is just, you know, all that you've been through with what you say about the country turning its back on you and not being able to continue on with sprinting the way you've given your life to it. If Charlie Francis presented you again, you know, the opportunity to take performance-enhancing drugs in order to compete, would it still be worth it for you? Would you do it again? Would you do this for your son?
If this is my destiny, it is. We know we are human beings. We're not perfect in this world. People do what they need to do to train hard, to recover, to peak, to do whatever. if this is my destiny to do it again, yes. But I can say that I will allow my son or my daughter or whatever to take performing drugs. I wanted to have a good education, a good job. They don't have to run track and field to prove anything to anybody that they're fast, they take the genes from Ben Johnson. No. I want them to have a good life and out of the media and everything. So that's what it is.
And this last question, what do you hope that this book is going to accomplish, revisiting the highlight and kind of the low point of your career?
He's going to accomplish that, to tell the world the real truth, that they know along that the testing that they came up with was fraud, it was bogus, it wasn't real, it was a fake. They lock away the lab report for 30 years. 30 years they locked me away for. 30 years. Why do they want to lock away for 30 years? Because they're guilt. They're guilt, they're liar, and the system is a systematic fraud, and these people can't be trusted. Plain and simple.
Do you miss the track? I mean, is it still something you miss, being out there competing when the Olympics roll around this summer?
No, I do what I need to do. I did it ready. I'm very proud of what I accomplished and what I've done over the years. So I mean, I can't run forever. I know that. So there's always next generation coming up, and now they are taking over and running. But I'm saying this for the last time, all these guys are running are in the past. They cannot run like Ben Johnson. They cannot run like Ben Johnson. Ben Johnson is the best there is in the 100-meter sprint. And they're trying to discredit my name. They're trying to erase my name, but they can't erase my name. I have lots of fans all over the world. I got a lot of fans here in Toronto. I have a lot of fans in Italy, in Europe, wherever I go and travel, worldwide. People love me. People talk to me. People want to take pictures of me, autograph and everything. They can't erase those love from people. They can't erase those love.
When did you know that you could be special in this sport? How old were you?
I was about 5-6 years old. My mom's always say, this kid's going to be a special kid for you. I didn't know what sports I'm going to be held. I didn't know what's going to happen. You know, I was a born sick baby. I was a miracle baby. And the Lord saved my life, and here I am.
Well, I guess what I want to get at is, at what point in your mind did you think, I could be the fastest man in the world? Do you remember that moment where it entered your mind that that was possible?
I would say around 1981 in Rome, when I was at the World Cup meet, or the World Cup trials in Venezuela, when I run 10:22 legal with no drugs. 10:22 I run in Venezuela at the Carrasque for the World Cup trials. I know in my mind then that I can do something great if I just keep going and keep believing.
At that point you thought, I could break a world record. I could be the fastest man who ever lived.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. I really appreciate your time today, Ben. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Tourist Information. The producers are George Alarcón-Swaby and myself, Bryn Jonathan Butler. Please subscribe or rate the podcast. It helps us to keep bringing them out. Thanks again for listening.